Interfaith dialogue between Christians and Muslims has been high on the agenda this week. Here in the Vatican, the Pontifical Council for Interreligious Dialogue held a two-day meeting with representatives of Cairo's Al-Azhar University, one of the most important centres of learning in the Islamic world. The annual meeting with members of the Pontifical Council marks the anniversary of Pope John Paul's historic visit to Al-Azhar in the year 2000 and takes place alternately in Cairo and in Rome. Meanwhile, the role of Christian churches in the Middle East was the subject of a one-day seminar organized by the lay community of St. Egidio on Monday. The meeting brought Catholics and Orthodox leaders and lay people together with Muslim scholars from Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, Egypt, Saudi Arabia and Palestine to discuss the rich heritage of Christianity in the region and the problems that persuade so many families to leave in search of a better life elsewhere.
There are many reasons. Economical reasons, political reasons, etc. But I think there are new reasons. There is the fear of fundamentalism.
Latin Rite Archbishop Jean Suleiman is originally from Lebanon, but as the current head of the church in Baghdad, he's seen firsthand the devastating effects of the huge exodus of Christians fleeing the recent violence. About half of the community living in Iraq is believed to have fled since the US-led invasion and the ensuing sectarian conflict. I asked Archbishop Suleiman if it's still possible to talk about a real role for Christians in the country today.
I think it's still possible, but it's important that the churches have to be convinced that their role is still important. When you notice the immigration, you are not sure that Christians are still convinced that their role is important in the Middle East.
Are they mainly emigrating for security fears, or is it the economic problems that they're leaving for?
We had a small discussion about the reasons of emigration. There are many reasons, economical reasons, political reasons, etc. But I think there are new reasons, especially in some countries like Iraq or Palestine, where Hamas is ruling, etc. There is the fear of fundamentalism. There's a fear to be again dhimmi. It means legally discriminated citizens.
And yet, paradoxically, we've been hearing that the exodus of Christians will lead to an even greater fundamentalism. Do you share that fear?
I think yes. Yes, because the problem is the problem of others. When you are alone, you are not able really to open yourself to others, to hear others. It's a real danger for Arabic countries.
What are you trying to do within your own church there in Baghdad to try and stop people leaving?
I am a foreigner in Iraq. So when I am in Iraq, I tell people, I am a foreigner, I am serving here. It means indirectly that I am inviting you to stay here. But as you know, there is a freedom of immigrating. And sometimes we are without answers to people who are suffering, to families who are who think on the future of their children, etc. We don't have many possibilities to solve many problems except by our testimony to continue to serve the church even in difficult times.
What would you like to see from the churches here in the West, for example? How can they better support the churches there in the Middle East?
I think if they try to put the governments to help Iraq to find again its sovereignty, its peace, and especially the primacy of the law in the life of nation. If the state becomes again a state of law, many problems will be solved because law is a warranty for justice, for equality, for all citizens to share the same political life in the country.
Do you see that there have been some improvements over these recent weeks, a slight decrease in the violence?
Yes. I can say it now, even if I'm afraid that the real reasons of wars, of internal conflicts, of violence in Iraq I think, are still there. But there is less violence than before. And the elections show that people is exhausted by the violence and by the fundamentalists and the extremists. I think they choose, most of Iraq citizens choose the party of the law and the state and the party of lay people, of lay politicians. So it's for me it's a good sign of maturity, maybe, or of a renewed will to live in peace and with all the citizens without discrimination.
A new sense of hope there from the Latin Rite Archbishop of Baghdad, Jean Suleiman. But the problem of Christians leaving the Middle East affects all the churches in the region and should be an issue of great concern for Muslim leaders there as well. That's according to a leading Muslim intellectual, Mohammed Samak, who serves as General Secretary of the Committee for Muslim-Christian Religious Dialogue in Lebanon.
Well, because the Christian migration means the dismantling of the fabric of the Oriental societies, which is made of Christian and Muslim threats wrapped together to have this tapestry, which we call the Orient. Now, when the Christians leave, partly or in big number, this means dismantling the societies and endangering the unity, the national unity in each of the Arabic countries. And it will give a message that Islam is not accepting Christians, which is not true. Because in the fundamental teachings of Islam, believing in Christianity is part of the Islamic belief, of the Islamic doctrine. And living together is an Islamic, in the Islamic teachings. So, but those who will benefit from this migration are the fundamentalists who refuse the other, whether he is a Muslim or a Christian. Anybody who does not share them, their belief is considered an enemy, so they kick him out. That's why the more the Christians leave the Middle East, the more the fundamentalists will feel at home and dominate the place. They feel the vacuum. We don't want the vacuum to be in the Middle East by the immigration of the Christians. And so that's why it is in the interest of Islam, in the interest of Muslims, that Christians of the Middle East remain in the Middle East.
It's easy to see in your own country, perhaps Lebanon, where Christians are a far greater minority, far greater in numbers. It's not so easy in countries where they're a tiny minority. This kind of message, do you think it's getting through to the governments?
You see, this is the problem, to think of Christians through the concept of minority. This is really will not lead to the proper conclusion. Christians are part of the Arab majority. Ethnically speaking, they are Arabs, and they were there. So being Christian or Muslim or Jew or whatsoever, this is something else. People should not be classified according to religion.
But many of them are classified according to religions on their identity cards.
This is wrong, and we shouldn't follow this classification. And that's why they should enjoy their full rights as citizens, not as Christians or Muslims. See, a Muslim living here in Italy or in France or in UK is not classified as a Muslim, he is classified as a citizen. He has the right as a citizen. There are no rights for Christians or Muslims. This should also be in the Middle East.
How can you propose that happens in many of the Middle Eastern countries today, where it is such a critical issue?
We have to upgrade the level of culture, of understanding, of education in the Middle East, and to upgrade the standard of living also, so that Christians in the Middle East will, as well as Muslims, will feel equal in front of the law. Because, you see, they made these independent new countries, Christians and Muslims together. They were against imperialist movement in the process of building their countries. So they are equal. And they should be treated equal, equal rights and equal duties.
What is your message then to the Christian leaders as they try and confront this problem, a real problem of demographics, but also, as you say, to try and change the mentality to see it as a common problem?
Well, the starting point here is that to think of this problem not as a Christian problem, but as a Christian-Muslim problem, as an Arab problem, as a social, economical, political, as well as a religious problem. It's you have to look at it from all angles, with the eye fish to see the different angles. And here comes the responsibility of Muslims, sharing Christian leaders to deal with this issue. It's more dangerous and more complicated to be left to Christian leaders alone. It is a Christian-Muslim responsibility.
A need for Christians and Muslims then to tackle more closely the many problems they face in Middle Eastern societies today. But what role can the many religious dialogue meetings play in helping to promote this constructive interfaith cooperation? Bernard Sabella is a professor of sociology at Bethlehem University in the West Bank and has been taking part this week in both the St. Egidio and the Pontifical Council meetings.
Let's face it, I mean, the Middle East is a problem area. I mean, on the face of it, we always stress that we have common bonds, common religious principles. But in reality, we have divergent worldviews. And these worldviews affect how we deal with each other. And the nature of society, and the nature of the state, and the nature of government. And so at least these events are important in maybe creating, I wouldn't say even middle ground, but creating a way of saying that we have problems, we have to deal with these problems, and we have to create something in common. Call it middle ground, call it whatever you want. And in order to create a vision for the society and for the state that is inclusive and not based strictly on religious principles. That's why I'm really worried when there are calls to return everything to religion. You know, you can practice religion, nobody is arguing that. But when you reduce everything to religion and you say religion is going to give us all the answers and put practicalities on the ground that are religiously based, then you are likely to really exclude others. You are likely to exclude others. Hala, on a theological, doctrinal manner, yes, you can say, I have the truth, I have the absolute truth, whatever. But on a practical level, when you have various groups living on the ground, You have to take that into consideration in order to create the kind of society that is inclusive, that is accepting of each other. And so how do you then manage these two? On the one hand, you have the universal truth, the only truth, and on the other hand, you have different truths competing on the ground.
Where do you see the role of St. Egidio in this? Is it particularly well-placed, do you think, to be able to pursue this kind of dialogue?
I think St. Egidio keeps the debate going. And in itself, irrespective of what perspective it comes with. But the fact that it keeps the debate on, whether in the Cyprus meeting, whether in the meeting in Naples, Napoli last year, whether in this meeting here, the debate is going on. My problem usually with religious dialogue and usually interfaith dialogue is we are not so faithful to what we say in these kinds of dialogues. And I'm not trying to offend anyone, but I think that if we want to establish a joint base for looking at the problems, then when we go back home, we have to translate that into programs, into action, into educational agendas. And I have looked again and again into conferences of this sort, and I have come to the same conclusion, that all of them come up with fantastic, beautiful proposals. But often, when you examine the follow-up, what has been done, these remain words, as we say in Arabic, words in the air. Kalimat fil hawa. And so how do you translate that? For example, if I want to teach my students at Bethlehem University as an example of accepting the other, how do I do it? Do I just do it as an individual effort? I'm a good person, I'm a good Catholic. Or do I develop really programs and activities that will lead us into a sort of a more profound knowledge of the other and hence of accepting the other? And for us as Christians in the Middle East, this is very important.
Is there any possibility of doing that today in Bethlehem, in Palestine?
Yes, we do it. We do it. Don't forget that the media plays a very important role. And one of the things that the media has done, the Arabic media has done, is that they have highlighted some religious figures who speak very good Arabic and who speak for Islamic-Christian good relations. But this is, in my opinion, superficial. It remains superficial. A lot of things in the media are superficial.
It doesn't go back to the base, in other words.
Exactly, exactly, because you have to get to the students, you have to get to the masses, you have to get to people. And the problem often is that people have misperceptions about the other and about the religion of the other. And these misperceptions, even though they are counteracted by being good neighbors, by being side by side, yet they remain, whether on this side or that side, whether on the Christian side or Jewish side or Muslim side. And therefore, the challenge is then, how do you go from these misconceptions and misinterpretations and come to a common ground? And in order to do that, you know, a dialogue is important, but important as a basis and not in and by itself. Because in and by itself, dialogue doesn't mean anything. It remains limited, as many people have said. And yes, I have my opinions, I have my good intentions towards the others, but when I go home, I stick to my group. And so in a sense, you have to be accountable to what you say in dialogue groups.
My thanks there to Professor Bernard Sabella from Bethlehem University. And earlier you heard Professor Mohammed Samak, Secretary General of the Committee for Muslim-Christian Religious Dialogue in Lebanon, and the Archbishop of Baghdad, Jean Sleiman.